Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
I'm Erica Weitz, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb, coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. I write about food, and my favorite part about what I do is finding out the stories and meeting the people behind great recipes, restaurants, and more. And every Wednesday, I get to have these conversations live on air to bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life by interviewing some of the most interesting women in the world of food. You can listen to the show every Wednesday at 2 o'clock on heritageradionetwork.org or download it anytime on iTunes. I'm very, very excited about today's show. Anita Lowe, the acclaimed chef and owner of Anissa in Greenwich Village, is here, along with her chef de cuisine, Mary Atia. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, awesome. In my opinion, and I know I'm not alone in this, and really it's not an opinion, it's just a fact, Anissa is one of New York's greatest jewels. It's one of the most long-standing, elegant, and I would describe it as a refined but relaxed restaurant. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Thanks so much for coming here. It's a real treat to have you both here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
We're going to touch on some sort of big themes today, mainly working your way up in a kitchen, also the dynamic of a mentor-mentee relationship, and also the idea of community in the restaurant industry. But first, for anyone listening who doesn't know about one or both of you, I wanted to start with a little bit of background information. So, Anita, how old is the restaurant?
14 years. We opened in 2000.
Wow. I kind of think of restaurant years as kind of like dog years.
Yeah, I'm really old.
Yeah. Yeah, so 14 years in New York, it's quite a number. I think I'm going to ask you about your bio sort of background in a second, but before I do, I think in researching for the show and just knowing your restaurant and being familiar with your book, I think there's a lot that has been said about you, including Cooking Without Borders, which is the title of your cookbook, which you wrote with our beloved friend Charlotte Druckman. Sort of seems like a perfectly summed up description of your approach to food. And in Pete Wells' 3-star review of the restaurant this past year in the New York Times, he spoke about how tempting it is to try to understand your food through your background, and that biography only takes you so far. So even with these sort of big understandings of crossing borders and everything, where are you from originally?
I'm originally from Michigan, like a suburb of Detroit.
And what kind of food did you grow up eating?
All kinds. My mother was Malaysian, Chinese, so I grew up with. And Malaysia has many different cuisines within those borders. So I grew up with Southeast Asian food, Chinese food. My father was from Shanghai, but he died when I was very young, and I grew up with both my parents worked, so I grew up with a lot of different nannies, and my stepfather was. You know, he was from Denver and spent a lot of time in New England, and his family was German. So I just grew up with
everything.
A ton of different...
Yeah. Amazing. And Mary, where are you from?
I'm from Buffalo, New York.
From Buffalo?
Yeah.
Home of the chicken wings?
Home of the chicken wings.
Do you enjoy chicken wings?
I love them.
Okay, awesome. and how long have you been cooking at Anissa?
It's actually 3 years, I believe. Like 2 days ago was the third year.
Happy
really?
Anniversary.
Yeah.
End of July. Celebrated.
Yeah. Cool. So I would love to talk a little bit more about the restaurant. And I'm going to borrow again from Pete Wells' review because I thought there were just some pretty great lines in it. And he said, sort of referencing that idea of cooking without borders, that what's remarkable about your food is not exactly the absence of borders, but the ease with which you cross them. And he ended the review, I thought, very beautifully by saying, it's still not easy to say what your style is, or he said, what Miss Lowe's style is, but it is hers and hers alone, and the city is a more exciting place for it. And I can really think of no better praise. But Anita, I'm wondering specifically, how do you describe the restaurant, both the feel of it and the food you cook?
Well, it's contemporary American, which befits a very large country. It's a large category that befits a large country. You know, I can bring in influences from all over the world, with that category, the America's built by immigrants, so and especially here in New York, you have everything. So it works. It is a personal style. It's upscale. I'm French trained, so I do. That is the base. I worked at Chanterelle, I worked at Boulay, and in France. It's an elegant space. It's small, intimate. Hopefully, we really try to be welcoming and we try to, anticipate the customer's needs. So.
Having had experience a little bit being a customer, I would say you succeed in all of the above.
Oh, thank you.
I'm curious, is Anissa now what you envisioned it would be 14 years ago?
Yes, exactly. I mean, when we went to go open this restaurant, I wanted a restaurant that had a very diverse clientele, and we really do have a diverse clientele, it's a small restaurant where I can really control the quality, and it's a familial atmosphere. I really think that my staff are all wonderful people that are all very talented, very smart, and very team oriented. So, I'm happy.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. So. I'm happy to hear that. How big is the restaurant? How many seats are there?
We've got 48 seats.
And including the bar?
No, and then with 6 seats at the bar.
Okay. And how big is your staff? How many people in the kitchen?
How many do we have in the kitchen there? We have
five
cooks.
Four and a half.
Four and a half, yeah.
I'm half.
I'll be the half, yeah. we have four full-time cooks. And we have prep cooks and, dishwashers, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. It's great to learn those sort of, ins and outs of a place that is just so wonderful. I want to talk a little bit about working your way up in a kitchen which essentially is just how to build a career. Anita, what was your road like to reaching the point where you could open your own restaurant?
You have to take a lot of risks. I worked at Boulay. For a little under a year, and then I worked at Chanterelle for about a year and a half, and then I became a chef. I worked at three restaurants after that. My memory is going. I'm getting to that point. They have 14 dog years of restaurant. We opened a I started in 1988. I started cooking in 1988, and I opened in 2000.
Did you, previous to 1988, were you thinking about cooking? Was that your intended profession? Did you have any other?
No, I was majoring in French, and I thought I was going to go work at the UN or something like that. But then I was taking language courses in Paris. My school had a program over there, and I just fell in love with that culture and that city. And I had to go back, and I was learning how to cook for myself at the time, and I was just really passionate about food. Mm-hmm. And so I went back and took cooking classes. And at that point, I was like, okay, this is what I'm going to do.
You took the classes in Paris?
In Paris, okay. Yeah. And so I was like, this is what I'm going to do, and this is what, this was a good way to keep up my French language skills. I went to work at Boulay.
Yeah, for sure.
And I haven't really kept up my French language skills.
That's so funny. Well, never too late. Mary, you started your career in restaurants in the front of the house, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so how did you make that transition to the kitchen?
I moved here originally for graduate school, and started working in a restaurant just for extra money and had no experience waiting tables. So I started as a busser at mm-hmm. this restaurant around the corner in the Upper East Side. And I ended up dropping out of graduate school and, just was like, oh, can I come in the kitchen one day? And the chef was like, yeah, come on. So I started actually going in for once a week for a couple months, and then that restaurant closed. So I actually started looking into culinary school then. And in the meantime, got a job waiting tables at Aqua Grill, and then just took a little hiatus from the culinary school mm-hmm. idea. I was, you know, I think waiting tables in New York gives you a nice flexible schedule and
absolutely
a fun time. So, so I was enjoying that. And I actually, you know, I'm really happy I did the front of house first because I think it made the transition to the back 100 times easier because yeah. I understood how restaurants functioned. I understood the lingo in the kitchen. So walking in, it wasn't this foreign experience
for sure. Yeah, that's a good introduction. Yeah. And I'm sure it's probably helpful for you as a chef to have an understanding of what's happening to your food when it leaves that kitchen door.
Yeah, it's, you know, everybody's functioning together and to know what the front of the house is doing and what their, you know, intentions are and, mm-hmm. and the steps they have to take helps us in the kitchen.
Sure. Yeah. So you didn't go to culinary school, or you did?
I ended up going 3-4 years ago now, and went to ICE. Did the 10-month program there. And
that's a question that comes up a bit when I'm talking with chefs. It's sort of that sort of idea of, is it worth going to culinary school or not? So in your experience, are you happy you went? Or are you?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I am happy I went. I think everybody's different. For me, I just wanted to know those fundamentals. Mm-hmm. And I know you can learn them in kitchens, but, you know, oftentimes kitchens have adapted or tweaked certain basics. So it was nice to go in with a foundation of, you know, understanding certain foods and techniques. But it really is in the kitchen where you start learning.
Yeah.
But I agree. I think do everything.
I'm a big fan of knowing the rules before you break
them. Right, right, exactly. So for me, that works. I don't think it would be great for everyone, but, you know, I liked that structure. And
Anita, what do you think is culinary school, like when you're hiring people, is that something you require? What do you think about it?
Not at all. If I'm hiring into, an entry-level position like garde-manger, I do look for people that have either a culinary degree or experience, mm-hmm. a little bit of experience. I do have a cook right now who's very talented who never went to cooking school. That's usually rare, but cooking school is a luxury, and it does help you, helps you to understand basics and how things work. And I don't think it's absolutely necessary, but I think it's
can't hurt.
Yeah, definitely doesn't hurt. Yeah.
And sort of just talking about this theme of working your way up and getting your foot in the door, what other qualities do you look for when you're hiring, both in the kitchen or front of the house?
I look for even-tempered people that are really passionate. I need somebody that's really passionate about food, at least in the back of the house. And you know, just loves to eat. I need someone with a good head on their shoulders that's dexterous and I need someone who's adventurous. Like the cuisine at Anissa can be challenging to some people. I mean, we do bring in some foreign ingredients and stuff. I don't know. It's important to me that my cooks be excited by new things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, excitement, I think, counts for a lot.
Yeah.
Big time. Mary, what advice would you give to young chefs who are looking to get their foot in the door?
Just go and pay attention. Observe and ask questions. And don't be afraid to, you know. I think, you know, most chefs aren't upset if you're curious about what you're doing. So I think, you know, taking notes and just paying attention, even at moments that you think nothing is going on, something is happening. And if you let your, you know, get distracted or start checking your phone or start, you know, it's just, those are signs that, you know, your head's not in the game.
Sure.
Always ask if there's something you can be doing. And
that's good advice. Yeah.
Just pay attention.
Yeah. And where, Anita, where do you go, to sort of find inspiration or to sort of recharge your inspiration batteries so you can sort of, you know, keep that going in your kitchen?
Oh gosh, I find it everywhere. You know, it can be like going to visit farms. It can be traveling to foreign countries. It can be just reading. It can be going out to dinner. I can even find it in my own kitchen. Sometimes a cook or even a prep cook will make a staff meal and bring something in that I find interesting.
That sounds great. And so are you at the point now, how much time are you able to spend on those kinds of things? Like how many nights a week are you at Anissa versus being able to go out to dinner?
Well, I just had a knee replacement, so I haven't really been able to be on the line as much as I should. But
that's no joke.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm probably going to have to get the other one done too. But it's it's been interesting. It's a I'm 48 years old. It might be time for me to try to take a little bit of a step back. And I really have the talent here now.
And at what point during the sort of 14 year period of having the restaurant did that sort of shift start to happen? When were you able to, you know, start to feel comfortable to not be at the restaurant every day?
I've traveled over the years. You know, I had a great sous chef, Titus Wang, who just got Zagat 30 Under 30, who made it very easy for me to travel. Mary's our first chef de cuisine, so that really has Mary's really made it easy for me to go out and do some of these other things that I probably should be doing.
That's wonderful. And is that correct that you, so you're the first chef de cuisine, so right. You sort of created this role for Mary, yeah.
Yes.
And tell me a little bit about that moment of making that decision to go from having traditionally sous chefs to having a chef de cuisine.
Well, I couldn't walk anymore. So many years of working, you know, standing up every night and running up and down the stairs and et cetera, just wore down all the cartilage in my knee. Mm-hmm. And it was becoming apparent that I couldn't... I couldn't physically do this.
Sometimes your body will make it known before.
Yeah, but my brain wasn't as smart enough to stop before I lost my knee. But it's, I got a brand new one.
Yeah, that's great.
Totally titanium, top model. It's great. Yeah.
It's like getting a new car. Yeah.
There you go.
It's a new one to get around. I realize we're talking about this role of chef de cuisine, but a lot of people might not know where that is in the sort of hierarchy of the chef world. So... am I correct? And a chef de cuisine is a step higher than a sous chef. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's sort of executive chef, chef de cuisine, then sous chef.
Yes. And, okay. You know, Mary's really contributed to the menu more than anybody, I mean, as a chef de cuisine should, but more than anybody ever. I mean, I've always been very alone in my, in creativity at Anissa. So.
But it's a real testament to finding the right person for that role to be able to expand the menu and
I really believe that you have it or you don't, you know. I mean, I think it's there's no amount of training that can really make you creative.
Absolutely. All right, we're going to talk a little bit more about the menu and about your sort of relationship in the kitchen and how that all works, but first we're going to take a quick break, so we'll be right back.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third generation cure masters producing the country's best dry cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
Hi, and welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm your host, Julia Tershin, and we're back with Anita and Mary. We're just catching up a little bit more on Anita's knee, which I didn't realize is such a huge thing to recover from. But it sounds like this happened at the right time because you've got a great person in place in the kitchen, Mary, who can be there when your knee won't let you. So talking about this sort of mentor relationship, Anita, I want to sort of go backwards a little bit. Who was your mentor before you became one yourself? Did you have one or did you have a few or none?
I think David and Karen Waltuck were clearly my mentors. I don't know if David was really comfortable with that role, but... you know, I always think of them as my restaurant parents. And
are you still close with them?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And he just opened a new
place.
Yeah,
he just opened Elan, and it's fantastic. Yeah. I'm really excited for him.
That's really cool. Yeah. I feel like when you're talking about getting inspiration from all sorts of places, including staff meals, as someone who's worked on cookbooks my whole life, their staff meal book to this day is like one of my favorite cookbooks of all time. And
I learned so much from staff meal there. I mean, it was at the time you couldn't pay, $50, which was a lot of money back then, to get that kind of quality food. It was just, the sous chef cooked it 5 days a week and David cooked it one day, or 4 days a week and David cooked it one day. And, it was always, like, great stuff.
Yeah, the recipes in there are so, like, I think, and that book's not, like, that new anymore. It's been around for a while, but it still feels really, like, the kind of comforting but contemporary food you want.
Timeless,
yeah, totally. It also speaks to the camaraderie of what goes on in a kitchen and sort of taking care of each other. And,
yeah, I learned a lot from that. I think, I worked in other kitchens where you never sat down. It's really good for morale and teamwork between front and back, I think. Back of the house. Yeah.
And what time does staff meal happen at your restaurant?
4:30.
4:30.
And on the dot.
Yeah. And who makes it?
We all share. Each cook takes a day. And our prep cook actually takes a day as well.
Yeah, so. That's great. Yeah. And what's been your most recent favorite, both of you?
Let me think.
I don't know. Yeah.
Tirza made something delicious. What was it? Oh, well, also, Chris made that pulled pork. That was fantastic.
Ooh. Oh, I wasn't there for that.
Oh, that's the bummer.
Yeah. Mary makes great noodles. Yeah.
What do you mean? What kind of noodles?
You make ramen.
I've made ramen a couple times.
Awesome.
I've had fun with that because I had no idea. So it's just that the few times I've made it, I've just taken different steps the whole time.
I think that's the best place to start
when
you make something, to be that open when you have no idea what you're doing.
Yeah.
It's good for the cooks to actually be creative and have to make something that everyone's going to eat.
Right.
I love that. I always feel like I wish at so many restaurants I could just go to staff meal. I'll pay whatever you want me to.
Come. Anytime.
I'm careful what you say. Right. Take you up on that. So, Anita, when did you feel the sort of tide shift? Like, when did you feel like you became a mentor? Or I'm presuming that you feel that way, so.
I've always felt that it was my responsibility to mentor anyone that came through my kitchen and did well for me, gave me the proper notice, et cetera. Being a cook is really hard. I was a cook. We got paid nothing. We worked really hard hours, hard long hours. And I think, it's also a point of pride to see, people on your staff make it,
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. How would you describe the difference between being someone's boss and being their mentor?
Well, I think mentorship is more of a nurturing, it has nurturing connotations. You have to be a teacher. You have to help them along the way. Just being a boss is running the restaurant.
It's sort of like, I guess, like the emotional component.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about mentoring in a really sort of like logistic day-to-day way in the day-to-day sort of level in the kitchen. And I was thinking about this because I think it's really interesting in an established sort of very respected restaurant like yours. I think the menu rides this interesting wave between you have certain iconic dishes that don't come off the menu, and I'm thinking specifically about your foie gras soup dumplings. but you're simultaneously coming up with new dishes all the time. So with the sort of older established dishes that never leave, what's the process of teaching other people how to make them?
Mary can speak to that. I think it's you have to be on top of, you have to make sure the consistency is there.
Right.
Yeah. But I think, they trail and they learn the, I write out recipes. So it's consistent.
That's so interesting. Yeah. I always, cause I've worked with some chefs on, their restaurant cookbooks, and I feel like watching how a kitchen keeps track of recipes is always really interesting. And often it can just be through language, through speaking and, That's great to know that you have them.
Yeah, it has to be both here, just because it needs to be consistent throughout time and throughout. You know.
Have those dumplings in particular, have they changed at all, or it's the exact same as?
It's exactly the
exact same. Wow. And when was the last time you made them?
Oh God, I think. Well, you know, every once in a while, someone gets sick, and I have to do some stuff like that. But it's probably been a couple of years since I actually had to make them.
And do you make them now, Mary? Or
No, I did recently. Our prep cook was out for the day, and I had to, and it gave me a lot of respect for how he makes them.
Yeah.
I think I make one to his six, so.
He's made thousands of them by now, yeah.
When he does it Millions. 2 hours
like
a day, every
closed.
Day, yeah. But it's fun, you know, it's nice when you're not, when the pressure's not on and you kind of just can prep and kind of lose your mind in the process.
Is it, I find, that kind of task, right. especially when it's like sort of intricate work, can be very meditative after like you get the emotion down. Anita, is it strange at all for you in any way to sort of watch other people make dishes that you created? What's that feeling like?
Not at all. I think even sometimes I'll create a dish and it will evolve in the hands of one of my cooks. You know, and I'm still in control, like, if it... But a lot of times it can evolve in a better way, you know? It just... You know, the person that has to make it every day can come up with better ways of executing it. Sometimes I create something and it's just exactly the same, like the soup dumpling.
Mm-hmm.
But I really do believe in teamwork. And
wonderful. And what about new dishes? First of all, how often do new dishes come into the menu? How often does the menu change?
We change it seasonally, but it really depends on the weather and ingredients.
Sure,
So 4 times a year, but it evolves. It doesn't change like on, you know, June 23rd or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know?
And so when the new menus are created, you know, whether it's, you know, in little bits at a time, the new dishes, are you passing things along that you've come up with? Is it more collaborative? Are you creating these dishes? Are like the two of you working together to create dishes or with your larger team?
The two of us work together a lot on new dishes. Sometimes Mary comes up with dishes on her own, and sometimes I come up with dishes on my own. But for the most part now, we've been collaborating.
Yeah,
I know in the great Times Review, some of the dishes that you personally created were very much celebrated. The steak tartare, the rabbit, which was pistachios?
Pistachio and grape leaves.
Yeah,
and
delicious. Yeah. At what point did your creative input start coming into play on the menu?
I think the steak tartare was...
Yeah, we had. We actually. Did you know Batman, the photographer?
Batman.
His name is Batman. Alan Bat is his name, and he goes by the name Batman.
The other Batman.
The other Batman. But he does these cookbooks that all have a theme, and he sells them for charity, and all these chefs contribute, and he asked us to do a dish that came from two cultures. So we just thought, because I'm Chinese and her dad's Lebanese, so we thought we'd do something Chinese.
Like the two best cuisines in the world collide. So
well,
tell us about...
it's incredible. Like, when we started putting it together, the common ingredients we could find. And
explain the dish. How is it? What's in it?
The tartare itself is just the classic, like, kibinai, Lebanese dish, the raw. We use beef. A lot of times they use lamb. But it has bulgur wheat in it. My dad used to make it. He would grate onion into it, but we just chop some red onion, cinnamon, allspice, olive oil, a little lemon juice. And I grew up eating that, so to me that's just like a flavor that every time I taste it, it's, you know, all this nostalgia.
You know if it's right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, I love tasting it every night.
And you make it to order each time?
Right, yeah. Right. But then we, you know, brought in the tofu into it as a sauce.
Yeah, that was
so we made
idea.
A sauce out of it, which has tahini or and garlic, and so I don't know. We had like the black sesame as well. So we had sort of this like sesame and right. cinnamon and tofu, which are
sounds so good.
You know, bringing in the Chinese yeah. ingredients and chili oil.
Yeah, and Chinese then, chili oil. And we were going to use, which is kind of retro, but we were going to do like wonton.
Oh, right.
yeah, things, but we didn't have any, and I had all
like
of this.
Like a crispy.
Yeah, just right, a little yeah. crispy thing. Yeah. Was, you know, like I have like toast or whatever with it. But it was a little, I thought it was a little yeah. hokey. And then, but we had all that Brieck in house, yeah. so we ended up using that instead.
What's
and
that?
It's a North African flatbread. It's a, like a...
Very thin.
Tunisian. Yeah, Tunisian.
So that's yeah, the sort pastry. Of toast yeah. substitute.
Yeah. So we fry those, yeah. and it's just like a very delicate what? Chip, and it garnishes the
tartare.
That sounds
delicious.
So.
I think, I feel like there's my three, I love steak tartare, mm-hmm. beef tartare, and I think the three best I've ever had, or I have not tried this one, but I'm including it.
You're going to include
as if I've had it. But they're all in the West Village and all made by women, and the other is Jody's at Bouvette, uh-huh. which I think is delicious and
oh,
full of like,
yeah.
oh,
had
it's
it.
Worth it. Yeah. Full of like capers and mustard and mm-hmm. like super,
traditional.
Yeah.
Yeah, love that.
But just
yeah.
done so beautifully. And then Rita, who runs Isodi on Christopher Street, yeah. makes like a really beautiful one that's like a couple less ingredients and like plenty of like whatever. I don't know where she gets her bread from, but it's so
right.
good. And
mm.
I feel like I could do a little steak
right.
tartare
yeah,
bar hopping.
crawl.
Food crawl. Yeah. Tartare crawl.
It's like the paleo
yeah, exactly.
food crawl. Speaking of those two chefs who I love and who are all in the same neighborhood as you, the last theme I wanted to hit on was the notion of community in the restaurant industry. And specifically with women in the restaurant industry. And I think there's something so wonderful that at the core of Anissa is this dedication to championing women. And is it true the word Anissa translates to?
Yeah, it means women in Arabic.
Yeah. So what are some of the ways you sort of engage your sort of fellow chef community?
You know, I really only recently developed a, well, I guess I was working all the time, and I probably just didn't socialize that much. But like, recently, I've developed a really nice core group of female chef friends, which I'm just it's so wonderful. I'm really happy.
So that's
to have
something
that.
Sort
yeah.
of new. To you.
Well,
yeah.
not I mean relatively new.
Yeah.
In restaurant dog years, but it's, yeah, it's yeah. I mean, like 10 years ago, I think I didn't have that. Core group of chef friends.
I loved recently, we were talking right before we started the show that you were featured on Tea Magazine, this great story about your weekend house on Long Island about fishing with two amazing
yeah,
chef friends of yours, April and
Elizabeth
Faulkner.
Yeah.
And I think there's something, I was just so glad to see that, not just because it like looked like you guys were having a great time and the food sounded delicious and all those reasons you tune into an article, but just, it's great to see three sort of successful women who have built these amazing careers all being friends with each other and not competing with each other, and I just thought that was great. And I was wondering, do you think as the interest in and appreciation for food has grown, there's been an increased sense of community between female chefs? It sounds like there has been for you, but in general, do you think there has been?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think also, I mean, this past year when The Gods of Food came out, mm-hmm. I mean, I hate bringing that up again, but, you
it's
know,
like the broken record that we can't avoid. It's
I
like,
know,
yeah.
it really did bring a lot of people together, mm-hmm. I think, you know, just because it was such a wake-up call.
Yeah. I think sometimes, like, having something that seems, I know for me, that made me just sort of go, like, really? Seriously? Like, and so yeah. with a little bit of, you know, like anger or frustration when you realize you share that with other people, I think the best thing that can happen is it starts a conversation.
Absolutely.
And, yeah.
Absolutely.
So that's great to hear that it seems like that's really occurred at the chef level of the industry.
Yeah.
And where do you feel the community is going? Do you crave more community? Do you seek to bring more people together?
Yeah. I mean, it's always great to meet more, you know, women in the industry, because it is a struggle, and you share that common bond. But it's just, I do like to create community across gender borders as well. It's not, It's not just
an all-girls club.
But you know, it's really nice to have that girls club because, you know, I mean, the boys have always had their boys club.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think it's like that moment when you're like, oh, I just want my own club.
Right. Yeah.
I don't have to be part of yours. What about you, Mary? What do you feel like the temperature is among the sort of sous chefs and chef de cuisines of the food world?
I mean, my experience so far has, I think there's a new generation coming up where I think many of the great women before us have paved the way a little. I've only been in the Anissa kitchen so far, so I really haven't experienced too much, you know.
You went to the right place.
Right, exactly. You know, feeling left out of any club. But, you know, when I started, Danny Wang was the sous chef, and he was incredible. And, you know, I didn't ever feel any sexism or anything from him. And
We wouldn't hire people like
exactly.
that.
Exactly, yeah. You know, I'm in the right environment. Yeah. But I don't know. I feel hopeful.
Yeah,
you know,
that's great to hear.
You know, coming across contemporaries and other people at my level that I've met, you know, everybody seems excited, and it seems to be a little less of an issue. But I don't know.
I think it really is less of an issue for the younger. Yeah.
Well, I think thanks in large part, just as you said, to there being women like you and April and, you know, all these women who are running these great restaurants with kitchens that support talent like yours. Right.
And it's incredible to watch, you know, everything they do on all different levels, from, you know, April having like an empire and, you know, watching
Elizabeth
different
on
styles,
TV.
Elizabeth on TV. You know, like everybody sort of has, you know, a world and but also comes together and it's nice to see.
Yeah.
It's inspirational, you know.
For sure. Anita, is there more TV in your future? I know you've had a few experiences.
Oh, I don't know what I'm allowed to talk about. I haven't competed again. Yeah. I think those days might be over, but, you know, you can never say never.
Wait till the other knee is.
Yeah, exactly. I think I need more titanium.
I wonder if that's like a unfair advantage or anything. Before we cut to the Cherry Bomb Rapid Fire Q&A, which I'll explain in a minute, I wanted to ask you, just in terms of championing women, this just came to mind. Can you tell us a little bit about your wine list?
Oh, yes.
That's a wonderful thing.
So Anissa means women in Arabic, and we, because of that, we thought it would be interesting to celebrate women in wine through our wine list. And because we're contemporary American, it's a global list, there's so much wine out there. It wasn't hard at all, and it's... it makes it easier because you don't have to look at everything. But
it sort of narrows it down.
Yeah,
so every wine on your list is made by...
Not everything, but it's mostly female vintners, some vineyard owners, and it can be like a husband and wife team. Mm-hmm. And we do have one wine on there that just has no women, but just because it's so delicious.
But that's sort of to your point of it, you know, it doesn't have to be an all-girls club. It's just, you know...
Just celebration,
sort of like, yeah. No, I always think, I went to Barnard, so I can get a little nerdy on this, but it's like, I think women's rights is just human rights, so it's like, if the wine is delicious, put the wine on the list. Yeah, but that's super. I think I love that happens kind of in every department of your restaurant, and I think it's a nice area to bring women into the picture and into the mix. Super. It's so great to talk to you guys about all this. We're going to go into the Cherry Bomb Rapid Fire Q&A, which I mentioned, which are a series of fun questions we ask every guest who comes on. No pressure.
Sounds like pressure. Rapid fire.
I build it up.
Okay,
let's see. Anita, I'm going to start with you. Sweet or salty?
Salty.
Mary?
Salty.
Salty. Anita, what did you have for breakfast today?
Coffee.
How do you take it? What kind of coffee?
I had iced coffee with milk. 2%.
2%.
Yeah.
What about you, Mary?
A banana and coffee. Same way.
If I were to look into your refrigerator at home right now, what might I be surprised to find?
You'd be surprised to find... What's in there that's weird? I've got canned duck fat from the 80s.
It's aging.
From France. Yeah, I don't know why it's still there. Goose fat.
Have you been in the same apartment? Is it the same refrigerator, or you've taken it?
Yeah, I've had it. No, it's actually a new refrigerator because the other one died on me. But it's I've lived in an apartment since 94 or something like that. So.
That's so funny.
Yeah, and I did take that with me from the upper west side. I'm not quite, you know, now it's just sort of a funny souvenir.
Do you plan to use it, or it's just, decoration?
It's just decoration, yeah.
What about you, Mary? Anything funny in the fridge?
No, I can't think of.
What about at the restaurant? What's the most surprising ingredient?
What?
Say something positive.
I don't know if there's any surprising ingredients.
I mean, you know, we actually, she has kept that walk-in so clean.
There
I
used
can't.
To be some surprising ingredients that are gone. Yeah. Now, maybe.
That's so funny.
I think everything's pretty, there's nothing too crazy.
I love nothing more than like an organized restaurant walk-in.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Like a beautiful thing.
It's really
to
amazing
behold.
Right now.
Well, I spend time doing it and then it's out of order within hours. So I've learned you have to like let go a little bit else.
Anita, what's your go-to snack?
I have so many. I really do have so many. I love eating arugula at night.
Arugula?
Arugula salads with just various things in it, yeah. Olive oil, really good olive oil.
That's so healthy.
Yeah. Well,
good
right
for you.
No, I mean, well, I also love Doritos. I love potato chips.
Do you ever put the Doritos on the arugula, or is
crazy? No, yeah.
What about you, Mary? Go-to snack?
Well, I guess the unhealthy, and I can't really keep them around because Oreos, I'll eat an entire packet. Like, I break them up in a bowl and pour milk over it. Like, it's cereal.
Like cereal?
Yeah.
I love that.
It's dangerous. I can't have them around.
So it's, like, all just dunked at once.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And then you just eat it with a spoon, and you eat, like, 10 at a time, but you don't realize it. So it's, I have to refrain from buying them.
The next dessert on the menu.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, God, if I could do that.
Anita, where do you want to travel to next?
Well, I'm going to Australia next week.
Oh, awesome.
So that's exciting.
Wow.
But I've always wanted to go back to Japan and visit the seaside.
Mm.
That's what I want.
That sounds amazing. I might come in your suitcase.
Yeah.
Mary, where would you like to travel to next?
Japan's been a big place. I would, just to be different, I would love to go to France. I've never been, and I feel like as a chef, it's kind of a thing you should
like
do.
Rite of passage.
Right. You know, so that would be great. And I would love to go back to Italy. I was there when I was 15, but I don't think you appreciate it as much. Mm-hmm. I would love to see more of the countryside there.
For sure. Anita, my last question is, what was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
Chicken paprikash.
Mm.
I had a nanny who was from Hungary, and she would make the most delicious chicken paprikash with fresh dumplings that she would make.
That sounds like
rich and
so comforting.
Yeah, comforting, yeah. Creamy.
Is it something you make now, or it's just sort of
every once in a while? I made it for staff meal a couple of times. Like, when I was in France, I would make it with creme fraiche.
That sounds not bad at all. Mary, what was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
Probably when my mom would put on a big Lebanese feast. Mm. You know, we didn't have them all the time. We used to have like different parts. You know, sometimes we have grape leaves, but when it was the whole thing.
And, yeah, what's involved in the
feast? There's so many things. She would make kibbeh, and then my dad would make kibbeh nai, the raw version. Hummus, baba ganoush, grape leaves, tabbouleh. Pita bread, and we would just, you know, eat, not even use silverware, just have our bread and eat it.
That sounds awesome.
And, yeah.
Cool. Those are both really great answers. Anita and Mary, I can't thank you enough for being here today. This was a very special show, and I appreciate you making the trip to Bushwick. For listeners who might want to visit the restaurant, all of the information is at anisarestaurant.com. And the restaurant is at, it's 13 Barrow Street?
Yes.
Is that right? Okay. And your book, Cooking Without Borders, is in bookstores, online. And your Twitter handle is Anita Lowe NYC.
Yep.
And you are Feed the Mary.
Yes.
I love that. And as always, thank you everyone for listening. Tune in next Wednesday at 2:00 on Heritage for another episode of Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thank you.
Thanks.
For-
listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.